Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Tonight on Your Legal Rights, with the participation and assistance of the Labor and Employment Law Section of the California Lawyers Association, we bring you a 2024 Employment Law Legislative Update. You know, you might think this show doesn't apply to you. After all, you're only on a temporary position, and the union only represents permanent employees in your position. Well, stick around. Things are changing both in the private and public sectors. The law is changing in areas as far-ranging as freelance workers to lactation accommodation to discrimination based on the way you got your driver's license. And as always, we want to hear what's on your mind and answer your questions. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, that's labor and employment law. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. But bear in mind that our guest can't provide you precise legal advice without all the facts relating to your case. But we're happy to pass along the legal principles to assist you in your decision-making. And the legal guidance provided mightn't be the positions of their respective employers or clients, but my guests are here to help. Joining us tonight, a partner in the firm Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, and Romo, Thomas Lenz handles all aspects of labor and employment law issues and heads the firm's traditional labor and national relations board practices. He works with employers in all major industries across California and the West. Tom is a recognized authority on labor and employment law and all issues pertaining to the National Labor Relations Board. Ellen Mendelson, who owns Law Office of Ellen Mendelson, a professional corporation here in San Francisco, represents public and private employees in discrimination, wrongful termination, disability accommodation, and disability retirement matters. Ellen serves as counsel for the San Francisco City Workers United, that's the painters union for the city, performs both contract negotiations and discipline and discharge representation for the union, as well as working with small employers. Mia Munro is a partner at Jeannie Harrison Law Firm in Los Angeles, where she represents employees on individual and representative basis to enforce their rights in the workplace. Mia also serves as co-chair on the legislative committee at the California Employment Lawyers Association, on the Board of Governors, and as co-chair of the Labor and Employment at the Women's Lawyers Association of Los Angeles, and as a volunteer attorney at Legal Aid Workers' Rights Clinic. Before moving to Los Angeles, Mia worked for 2 years at Equal Rights Advocates in San Francisco. And without further ado, Mia, Ellen, Tom, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
You know, there's a lot. You guys have dished out a lot for me to play with in the last day or so. But I'd like to ask about temporary employees and bargaining units. You know, I mentioned that at the beginning of the show. And this looks at the temporary employees when there's organized labor representing permanent employees. What's changed there?
On January 1st, 2024, AB 1484 was passed, which extends union membership to temporary employees hired to do the same or similar work as union-represented employees. It's a way of preventing union busting, actually, because there are times, many times, when public entities need temporary assistance. It's so difficult to hire a public employee. In San Francisco, it takes 456 days to hire a permanent employee. So that when they're short labor and they need to hire more painters, for instance, they sometimes take temporary employees, and those employees should have the opportunity and should be union members. And it's a way of preventing public employers from union busting.
You know, some of the suburban governments have some people hired as temporary workers. They may keep them on for years, but they're considered temporary. They get moved around and the like. But the union only has been historically representing those that are permanent. So when a permanent position comes up, it goes to somebody who's really close to the vest of the person who's in charge. And nobody else gets representation, and they're all paying union dues. Is this the kind of thing that is designed to meet?
Well, post-Janus, there was a decision from the United States Supreme Court that made public employee union membership not required. It used to be closed shops. You used to have to be a member of the union to work for the public entity in the job that was covered by the union contract. No longer. Now people can elect whether to be a member or not post-Janus. So it's to everybody's advantage, but employer and employee, to be a member of the union. It provides representation in the event that there's some issue that comes up regarding performance. It makes it easier for everybody, and AB 1484 mandates that these people, temporary employees, can be union members.
I'm going to play devil's advocate then, and maybe Tom, you might have a line on this too, but wouldn't that lead some of these employers to simply do an end run on the whole statute by simply saying, I'm going to hire contractors, independent contractors, instead of temporaries now?
You know, I think that in a labor context where you have unionized workers, any effort by an employer to go around the group that is represented by the union, to subcontract to somebody, to create a different relationship in order to get the scope of work done that the union represents, that's a potential issue for a lawsuit or a grievance or something like that. So I think what this law is going to do is it's going to really, I think, solidify the union status as representative, so that when they are negotiating terms and conditions for employees, it's going to apply to everybody. It's not going to be something where the employer can sneak out and, you know, make some side deals to call somebody a temporary and continue to get the work done without following the negotiated terms.
So I would imagine that if it's a job that they've hired out, independent contractors are gone to contract with subcontractors, so to speak, or others to do the work, traditionally, maybe they have more leeway. If they suddenly decide to replace temporaries with contracting out, maybe less so.
Well, in theory, although I think for labor and employment lawyers like us, anytime the term independent contractor is used, bells and whistles go off, because that's a disfavored status and people are presumed to be employees.
One of the areas that seems to have gotten a lot of legislative attention this term is broadly described as discrimination, but some of the types of discrimination that you've alerted me to, it's just amazing how broadly discrimination is being applied. One of them is discrimination in terms of leave and accommodation to victims or witnesses to violence. Tell us a little bit about that.
I can speak a little bit about that. So prior to this bill being passed this year, which is AB 2499, there already were protections in place for employees who are victims of certain kinds of violence. And they were permitted to take unpaid leave for specific reasons in order to recover from the violence and take care of themselves. The law this year has been pretty significantly expanded in recognition that victims need help from family members in order to recover. And so now the law has been expanded to cover unpaid leave for family members of victims who've suffered from violence. The unpaid leave, there's a discrimination and retaliation aspect to it in that if an employee takes this leave to help their family member recover from an act of violence, they cannot be discriminated against due to taking that leave. And there are also accommodation rights that protect them. The law only protects employees who are employed by employers with 25 or more employers, generally that discrimination law. So there are some limits, but this is going to, and from a worker's rights perspective, this is a really crucial law because workers who are suffer from violence, they disproportionately lose their jobs and get demoted because they can't access the services they need to recover. And that also disadvantages employers because employers have an interest in retaining talent and retaining good workers. And if they can just provide some limited accommodation to the workers so they can recover, it's better for everybody. There are a few more details I can go over. The types of services that the employees entitled to take leave for also have been expanded. For example, to get childcare, including a family member helping with childcare, to access services for victims, to get legal counseling, as well as to get psychological counseling and medical care. The list has been very significantly expanded. And from my perspective, it's really great for California workers as well as employers who are getting very specific guidelines on what they should be doing in these scenarios.
And if I understand it correctly, this doesn't say you get paid while you're doing these things, but it preserves your job for when you come back.
So there actually is you can use your paid sick leave that you've already accrued and you can apply it to the unpaid leave, but you're correct that generally it's an unpaid leave law where you could apply the paid sick leave you've already accrued.
It seems that's kind of related when you're talking about definitions of discrimination and definitions of things that are protected activities, kind of leads us to our next area, which talks about, well, we know that existing law, the UNRRA Civil Rights Act, eliminates or makes unlawful discrimination and people in certain classes. But it looks like that's being revised somewhat. How is that going to work?
So there are two laws that have been revised, the UNRRA Civil Rights Act, as well as the Fair Employment and Housing Act, which are two major anti-discrimination laws in California. And the I see this as a significant change, which is SB 1137, a law that clarifies that discrimination that is intersectional, which is kind of an academic term, but intersectional discrimination is illegal under the laws, which means that everyone has protected characteristics under the law. You can't be discriminated against because you're a woman. You can't be discriminated against because of your race, because of your age, your disability, all of these categories. And a lot of people, when they make claims, they just pick one, or they pick more than one, but they're separate claims. But this law clarifies that it actually protects people who suffer from discrimination due to a combination of protected characteristics, such as a woman who believes that she's been discriminated because she is not just a woman, but a minority woman, a Black woman, an Asian woman. And she sees, oh, well, they're treating that white woman better than me. So it's hard to make just a gender claim. And then they're treating that Black man better than me. So it makes it complicated, but Black women, women of color, older workers with disabilities, they're frequently at a significant disadvantage, and they're frequently targeted because of that combination of the protected characteristics. So this law clarifies that that is illegal under the law. And I can just give a couple examples of how intersectional discrimination works, like with respect to the wage gap.
So if I understand you correctly, maybe somebody feels that they're not being treated the same as others, but if it's a woman saying I'm not being treated well because I'm a woman, she may have a claim, she may have a weaker claim depending on how others are being treated. And maybe her ethnicity may not be enough because of the way others are being treated. But when you look at the combination of those two things, suddenly she can show that she's being significantly treated differently. And before, there wasn't a provision for you to show there were multiple causes.
Yes, I think you're interpreting that correctly, except that this law clarifies pre-existing law. So the legislature has declared that this has always been the law, but courts have not understood it that way. And so just to clarify that, and I can give you a concrete example of a case that the legislature said, we agree with this case, which in which an Asian professor, a female Asian professor, made discrimination claims. And the court initially dismissed the claims because the employer pointed to another Asian man who the employer treated well and pointed to a white woman who the employer treated well. The court said, well, because there are these other people with those statuses that the employer is treating well, you don't have a claim. And the Court of Appeals disagreed, the legislature disagreed, and specifically stated that people with a combination of characteristics can be their own separate category. So you can't just pull apart the different categories and then point to one employee with one overlapping characteristic and then a separate employee with a separate overlapping characteristic and say, okay, it's defeated now. You can't do that anymore under the law.
That would make sense. So it would be, there are those who don't want to see women in office, but we've all kind of grown up and gotten used to that. There are some that might not want to see someone of color in office. We've actually had that reach the highest levels of our government. Now we have a woman of color running for office. She's in a unique position. This law would recognize that.
Exactly. That's a perfect example of how this happens to people with combination of protected characteristics and how they are targeted by others.
I'd like to back up just a little bit. We were talking a bit earlier about discrimination, leave and accommodation for victims of violence or other protected activities, even being called on jury duty or serving as a witness in one of these cases or the like. And you had commented that you can use your sick leave presumably for such purposes. What about your vacation pay? Could you take a vacation day to do that?
That, I don't know the answer to that. I suspect that, I'm not going to posture on that. I don't know, Tom, if you know the answer to that, but that's not specifically covered.
I would think that that would be available to be used. I mean, as a way to be compensated for what might be otherwise unpaid leave.
Most employers now have a paid time off. It's not, you know, you use a PTO for whatever you want. I can't imagine that it wouldn't.
And just to be clear, we're talking about stuff that has not yet, really most of it's not gone into effect, much less been tested. So I threw a question out that it's understandable nobody would know yet. We're going to see what the courts do with it probably a couple of years from now. But theoretically, if they can't hold it against you that you had to be in court, the question is, are they going to want to let you burn off a day of vacation day or have you dangling? And it's not yet answered.
With something like vacation that is not legally mandated, a lot depends on how an employer writes a policy on it, how vacation is accrued. And certainly, you know, the law is employee-friendly, generally speaking, in wanting to allow employees to use time that they have accrued. So I think, you know, a lot of these laws, including the ones we're talking about right now, are things where employers are going to need to get up to speed and also modify policies to be in compliance.
And I think that employers generally would have an interest in allowing employees to use their vacation time. For that, another question could be, can they require them to do that? Which I don't read the law to permit employers to require them to use the vacation time for that. But that's also just another interesting question that might come up as the law plays out.
One of the other discrimination issues that's come up of late and appears to be addressed by recent legislation is about whether somebody's licensed to drive or not. Can they require your driver's license before they'll hire you?
So now there's a specific law that was put in place. It's called SB 1100 that limits an employer's ability to require employment applicants to have driver's licenses to be considered. And the law specifically prohibits employers to put in job applications and job postings and other similar material that it's a requirement for the job to hold a driver's license, unless the employer reasonably expects that driving will be one of the job functions. And also, the employer reasonably expects that an alternative form of transportation, such as ride sharing, would be cost prohibitive or not be comparable for the employer. So that's the specific law, and it's intended to address national origin discrimination. And discrimination against immigrants.
So if I'm working for an employer where I've got to carry a lot of their property with me and travel, I might not have as strong a claim against an employer who discriminates on this basis than if I'm supposed to just go there and have appointments and I could just as easily jump in a Lyft or Uber, if I understand you correctly.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Although, you know, what would happen with those costs? That's an interesting question, Jeff, because the employer has to pay the employee for mileage for using their own car. That's a cost of doing the work for the employer that they have to be compensated for. And if the Lyft or Uber was, I don't know how they'd even do that, quite frankly. To compensate an employee, would the employee bear the cost of that, or would the employer? And Tom is probably, this is more an employer's question than an Ellen Mendelsohn question.
What do you think, Tom?
I think this is just going to put the onus on employers to be more specific about what they want with employees. I think job descriptions should probably define whether people are expected to drive. And I think, employers are going to want to know, are you able to get to work? But when employers are, let's assume they're hiring somebody and they want to get the I-9 form filled out to confirm eligibility to work in the United States. It's not commonly known, and I'm going to mention it, employers cannot tell you as an employee what documents to produce. They can show you the list and ask if you're able to produce documents that are set forth there. So you might choose, employee, to present a passport, which is itself something that proves identity as well as employment authorization. Or instead of a driver's license, you might have a school ID card with a photograph. And a birth certificate. So these are the sorts of things that you might choose to produce. So, but many employers are often asking for driver's license and social security card. They're not allowed to do that. So this is going to require employers to, I think, review the law, tighten up their policies, and to make sure they're not doing something that either is actually intended to screen out immigrants who are eligible to work, or something that even impliedly, in effect, does that.
Does it change things if the passport is from somewhere other than the United States?
You know, that's a great question. I think it does. The list that the government puts out speaks specifically of, U.S. passport or U.S. passport card. There is a provision for a foreign passport that contains a stamp or notation regarding an immigrant visa. So there's also the possibility of a foreign passport with a specific form called an I-94 or I-94A. And I'm not an immigration lawyer, but I can tell you that those limited exceptions do apply. There's also a special provision for passports from Micronesia, the Marshall Islands, specifically designated locations, but generally I would expect U.S. passports or passport cards to be, the passport presented.
Seems to me where it gets complicated is where you see the intersection of state law not allowing an employer to discriminate against somebody who's an immigrant or based on someone's national origin when it intersects federal law, which does not allow employers to knowingly hire people that are undocumented.
Yeah, there's been a lot of tension between state and federal law in recent years, and there are rules referred to by the name of preemption, where federal law is deemed to control completely or in part things that the state may try to regulate. So I figure that if you have rules like this, clever employers who want to spend time in court may decide to, fight those issues and let the judges decide.
That does get rather complicated. I know federal law, they're very strict about who you can hire and who you can't, and doesn't really take into account certain industries where we would all be facing much higher prices if, for example, agricultural workers, just by way of one example, required citizenship.
Absolutely.
I agree.
And a number of other industries, the farriers, horseshoeing, and those industries tend to need foreign-born workers.
When we come back, I'm going to want to talk to you a little bit about outside of discrimination, some of the other things that have changed, certain presumptions that are in place when people, the public safety workers go to retire, evidence of harassment or assault, unemployment, things of that nature. But for now, we'll leave it here. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. And we'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we bring you a 2024 employment law legislative update. My guest tonight, Thomas Lenz, a partner at Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, and Romo in Pasadena, California. Ellen Mendelson of the Law Offices of Ellen Mendelson here in San Francisco. And Mia Munro of Jeannie Harrison Law Firm in Los Angeles. They're all here to help. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. We're talking labor and employment law. You don't have to jump into the same point we may be in our conversation. One other change that struck me being rather as interesting looks at a retiring public safety officer. I know for some things there's a rebuttable presumption that the disability arose out of their employment, but it looks like those were amended. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yes. Government Code Section 31720.91, which became effective on January 1st, 2024, provides a rebuttable presumption for safety members. The disability from PTSD arose out of and in the course of employment. They also, the laws were amended to cover safety member heart disease, tuberculosis, meningitis, skin cancer, Lyme disease, lower back impairments, hernia, and pneumonia. And this is for purposes of an industrial disability retirement. Most safety officers are covered by our safety members, our CalPERS, or the individual county retirement departments. This government code section is part of the CERL, the county employee retirement law. And it'll stretch over to PERS, is the public employee retirement system laws. And I always argue that they apply to all systems because it's a body of law that covers people who are seeking disability retirement from the applicable retirement system for injuries sustained in the job. And this presumption assists people in doing that. I've had cases where the employer challenges service connection. I've had, where they're saying, oh, you were getting divorced as well. And that's why you have PTSD, not because you had some life-threatening incident on duty. And that's, this PTSD presumption greatly assists in showing service connection. And the tax advantages of service connection are substantial.
But of course, it's not dispositive. It's a strong presumption.
Right. It is. It's rebuttable. If the employer has evidence, other evidence, and frequently the employer sends the member, safety member, to an IME with a psychiatrist who probes into the safety member's personal life and other things that may upset them, and uses that information to defend against the industrial claim.
See if they could push enough buttons to rebut the claim.
Yep.
While we're talking about probing such things, it seems there's been some change in what evidence is allowed when it comes to claims of sexual assault and harassment. How does that play out here?
So California has for decades had a statute in place, a law that is called the Civil Rights Shield Law, and it protects victims of sexual assault from having to talk about or expose their sexual conduct or sexual victimization in other circumstances not involving the perpetrator at issue in the matter at hand. So that law has been in existence for a while, but last year, the California Supreme Court made a decision that kind of took a few steps back from that. So in that case, it was a sex abuse case brought by a minor against her elementary school teacher. And the defense, the school, wanted to bring in evidence of another sexual assault that she had suffered from after that initial molestation. The California Supreme Court, although the law says you can't use that evidence to show either consent, that a victim consented to the perpetrator's acts, or to show a lack of injury for the acts that are at issue in the case. So evidence of other sexual acts, conduct, victimization shouldn't be used for that. But then in this case, the California, the defense said, oh, well, we're not using it for that. Instead, we're using it to attack the credibility of the victim about her testimony regarding her consent and about her injury. And the California Supreme Court said, well, there's language in the statute that supports that. So we're gonna say you can do that under the statute. So the legislature very quickly acted and said, no, you can't do that. So now the law is very clear that the defense in a sexual assault harassment case cannot use evidence of the victim's sexual conduct with someone other than the perpetrator or victimization with someone other than the perpetrator, either to show lack of consent with the perpetrator, to show lack of injury as to the incidents at issue, or to attack the plaintiff's credibility as to those issues. So that's what the new law has done. It kind of just put into place what a lot of people thought was the law already. But it's really important for victims. The whole purpose is we don't want to discourage victims from speaking out. We don't want to discourage victims from asserting their rights. And we don't want them to be harassed by the defendants in retaliation for asserting their rights. So that's the law is meant to protect that.
Sounds very similar to what's been in place in criminal for a long, long time.
Yes. Yes, and there are statutes that cover both and then statutes that don't cover both. Yeah.
Let me turn it over to Steve from Hayward. Steve, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, how are you? Good. Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate it. I wanted to ask Ellen one question. Ellen, can I sue someone who wrongly charges me with sexual harassment?
Effective 1/1/24, Assembly Bill 933 extended the defamation protections and that's from Civil Code 47, as privilege, any communication made by an individual without malice for claims of sexual harassment. Discrimination or retaliation regarding an incident of sexual assault, harassment, or discrimination. It also allows that person to get attorney fees and damages from the prevailing defense if they prevail in any action for defamation brought against that defendant for making that communication. So that it's kind of a restated application of the law, because you've never been able to sue somebody for making a complaint that's protected by law to an interested person. This clarifies and limits, not limits, but clarifies the terms and of defamation protection as privileged communications relating to sexual harassment, discrimination, or retaliation regarding an incident of sexual assault.
So I'd like to clarify that just a bit more. It sounds like a lot of it comes down to the good faith or malice of the person making the claim and whether they're really trying to disparage you. But I think we have somebody with us that may have had a hand in writing that law. Mia, I'm looking at you. Is that something that the committee you're on had a bit to do with that?
So the California Employment Lawyers Association Legislative Committee was involved in that legislation. You're right that there is the malice requirement. So in order to prevail on a defamation claim, yes, you can sue. You can sue an employer for accusing you of of sexual harassment or of an alleged victim. If you show malice in those communications, you could prevail, but it's become much harder to prevail and then to make it worthwhile to make those claims, because if the alleged victim wins on the defamation claim, they get their fees, they get triple damages for having to defend themselves. And the privileges were somewhat extended. There was always protection with employee communications with employers about sexual harassment. But now with this new law, there are also protections with employees communicating with other people, not just the employer, about what they believe is sexual harassment. So in the end, if one does choose to sue someone for defamation, for accusing them of sexual harassment, I mean, it could ultimately be a he said, she said, at trial, a factual issue. Where, you know, you'll get your jury trial and you'll see what the jury does. And there are incentives in place now to discourage alleged harassers from suing alleged victims for sexual harassment and assault.
So in answering Steve's question, it sounds like not only should he be in a position to show it's not true, but before he thinks about a claim of that nature, he'd better be darn sure that the person did it deliberately to mess him up.
Correct. And you know, when a victim is suing, or even like when there's a criminal prosecution regarding sexual harassment or sexual assault, there's always a defense that it's hard to beat when there are different perspectives about what happened. Well, that kind of flips when there's a defamation claim, where there's any ambiguity at all. That's going to be tough for someone to win on a defamation claim for that.
Defamation is generally a terrible cause of action. it's not something that I think a lot of lawyers would pursue.
I would agree. It's a hard case to bring, a hard case to win. When you have to prove malice, the standard is so high because of what courts have defined malice to mean, and the protections against retaliation for people who raise harassment allegations are so strong.
Especially if you do it in a manner that they say you're doing. If they can show you're doing it to keep them from certain activities, participating in public, things of that nature, the damages when you don't prevail, or even before you get to the point of prevailing, the damages are astronomical and they come out of nowhere quickly.
And one additional point as to that is, previously it would have been hard for a victim or an alleged victim to find a lawyer, to be able to pay for a lawyer on an hourly basis for this type of claim. And you weren't entitled to attorney's fees if you beat a defamation claim. Now there's an entitlement to attorney's fees and damages. And so now attorneys are incentivized, if they think that they're going to beat the defamation claim, they could, more attorneys are going to be willing to represent people have been sued for defamation if the attorney believes they'll beat it and get their fees out of it at the end.
Steve, right. Nobody's saying you can't do it, but you better be pretty sure. Steve, thanks for joining us on Your Legal Rights. Looks like there was some change around unemployment and strikes. What is that about?
The legislature passed and the governor signed a change to the unemployment laws, SB 1116, and to summarize it very quickly, if you were an employee that went out on strike at your workplace, and a reminder that you can strike either in a unionized workplace or a non-union workplace, and that's where you decide to withhold your services. If you did that, California law did not typically allow you to collect unemployment benefits. That has changed. I think the environment in the last few years, with so many people speaking out, not only on work issues, but on a lot of other social issues, has led to reconsideration of people's rights and whether they should suffer a loss due to their decision to engage in this activity. So California is now making unemployment benefits available to people who go on strike.
Let's talk a little bit about workers' comp. Was there a change? Sorry, we talked a little bit about the change in retirement, but what about workers' compensation? Has that had a significant change as well when it comes to presumptions of disability?
I think that's Ellen's.
That is. Ellen doesn't seem to hear me right now. Ellen, can you hear me?
I can. I was typing a question to Tom about the thing we just discussed. What was the question? I'm sorry.
We talked a bit about public safety workers and the rebuttable presumption about disability for purposes of retirement. What about for purposes of workers' comp?
The workers' comp creates there's a presumption in Labor Code 3212.15, effective 1/1/24, that creates a presumption that post-traumatic stress disorder arises out of and in the course of employment also. So that for comp coverage, usually mental health issues, and I'm not a comp attorney, but you have to prove that it's a more than a 50% contribution from work to get workers' compensation for a mental injury. And here, now if that there's now a presumption in the comp sections for safety members who suffer from PTSD that creates a coverable benefit under the comp system for a mental distress type injury, that you're not required to show that the work was more than 50% of the cause. It's presumed that arises out of the work. It's just for safety members, though. It's not for other public employees.
On the other hand, it seems to me, particularly if you're a first responder, I can't think of anybody who's more entitled to the presumption that that's what led to their PTSD.
That's true.
We spoke a little bit about temporary workers. What about freelance workers? Any changes there?
Well, with regard to freelance workers, SB 988 was signed into law, and that is going to be another exception to the rule presuming that people are employees, and you know, whether or not someone is an independent contractor. Of course, you know, there have been a lot of discussions about the gig economy over the years, and we've had programs on that, on Your Legal Rights. But freelance workers are among the groups who have lamented this higher standard to prove independent contractor status, that they're not employees, and some of them don't want to be employees. And as I think has happened many times, people lobby Sacramento and they say, I want an exception to the general rule presuming employee status, and they were successful. So freelance workers as long as they have an agreement which meets certain specified contents and so forth, they will be able to exempt themselves. So I think one of the things, particularly when you're dealing with people who consider themselves independent contractors, they probably aren't doing a whole heck of a lot of paperwork to prove that there's an arm's length transaction that is distinct from employment. This provision is going to give freelancers an opportunity, a roadmap, to have a written agreement laying out terms and conditions, which will enable them to more easily call themselves independent contractors.
The last thing I wanted to touch on today looks at meetings, and whether it's meetings in the workplace or mandatory meetings or freedom of association, it looks like there's been some changes there.
Yes, SB 399 was signed into law. This is legislation that is part of a trend. A number of states have signed this into law. Alaska is looking at it now. Washington State signed it into law a few months ago. And the essence of it is that certain subject matters should not be appropriate for workplace meetings requiring mandatory attendance. And in two big categories, you have politics and religion. And within politics, you have labor union matters. So if an employer wants to talk about politics and force you to be there, that's going to be illegal. If they want to talk about religion or have company-wide prayer, that's going to be illegal. Likewise, under this law, and I think this is where there may be some issue of potential conflict with federal labor law, if an employer wants to talk about a labor union with their workers, their position on labor issues, that would also be prohibited. Now, federal labor law gives employers rights in this regard. The courts have endorsed that, this issue is one that's in flux, though. So I expect some litigation on this to really test the law in the courts. But as far as this law is written, California employers are at risk if they have mandatory meetings. If an employee refuses to attend, they still need to be paid for the time. And there are penalties per employee and per occurrence. And all of this can be pursued either by an affected employee or in court, or by going to the labor commissioner. So there's going to be some interesting stuff happening as employers hold meetings, and if they're not aware of things, they could get themselves into some trouble quite unwittingly.
Well, I told each of you that I'd give you a couple of minutes, maybe 2 minutes each, for any final remarks. Who would like to jump out first? Mia, you want to jump in first?
Sure. Thanks everyone for listening. I think it's so important for employees to know their rights in all aspects, including in the workplace. Our livelihoods depend on being able to work and to be able to support ourselves. And in California, we have a lot of rights. We have a right to a safe and dignified workplace, to get paid what we earned, to get paid equally for equal work, regardless of gender or race, and to speak out and take action when we see that the rights of ourselves or the rights of workers around us are violated. But the laws are very complicated and they change every year. And frequently employers don't even know what the law is. And so it's really important for employees who think their rights have been violated or have questions to go out and try to find out about their rights are, and the way they approach that could impact their future employment. And there are so many legal services that are free that workers can look to in order to find out about their rights and get advice. And that includes Legal Aid at Work has a workers' rights clinic. Equal Rights Advocates in San Francisco has a hotline, and also workers can call private plaintiffs' attorneys, employment attorneys, and seek free consultations as well if they're thinking of making legal claims. So there are all of these resources out for workers, and it's just really important to know that there are these resources, and that if you think you need to take action, you really should talk to a lawyer who specializes in employment.
And after all, before you jump in and make a claim, talk to someone who knows. Make sure you're right.
Yeah.
Ellen, you want to jump in next?
I'll follow up on Mia's discussion. And in terms of contacting a lawyer or any person who practices law, we can't give advice. We can tell you what the law says, but we cannot. The attorney-client relationship begins when we give advice. So you can't call us up and say, what should I do? And we can tell you that you can file with the state agencies and federal agencies that investigate employment discrimination. That's FEHA, the Fair Employment and Housing Authority, or the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. We can discuss the types of claims that you could pursue, but we can't write a complaint for you or tell you what to write over the phone. We need generally to enter, the state bar requires that we enter into written contracts with clients. So that in terms of your employer and the issues with your employer and the duties of both the employer and the employee sometimes conflict, and I can't tell you how many times I've had people come and sit down across from me and say, I work in a hostile environment, and is there any other kind? There's tensions between what the employer wants and what the employee wants, and it's finding that happy medium that keeps things copacetic in the workplace. If you believe that you've been injured by something your employer has done, definitely contact an employment attorney or the equal employment rights people or any of the available, the Bar Association of San Francisco, the Lawyer Referral Service rocks.
And we'll give that number out again in just a moment. Let me turn it to Tom to bring us home.
Thank you, Jeff. In summing up what we've been talking about, we've just scratched the surface on new laws. And I represent and advise employers. There's a lot of homework that needs to be done between now and the end of the year. A lot of employers aren't going to do it, so I will be repeating my message after the start of the year and trying to shore up as much damage as I possibly can if they're not in compliance. So update policies, make sure that what you do is consistent with what you say. And the other thing I want to do in terms of outreach is to mention the California Lawyers Association has helped create a workers app. You can download that for free, and it talks about basic rights. So it goes to what Mia and Ellen have been talking about. Thank you all very much for the opportunity to collaborate on this program tonight. Great to be back.
And thank you all for joining us tonight. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight we've been presenting an employment law update with Thomas Lenz, a partner at Atkinson, Andelson, Lawyer, Rude, and Romo in Pasadena, Ellen Mendelson of Law Office of Ellen Mendelson in San Francisco, and Mia Munro of Jeannie Harrison Law Firm in Los Angeles. A big thanks to tonight's guests and to the Labor and Employment Section of the California Lawyers Association, and on behalf of Your Legal Rights, a big thanks to all of you for listening. And at the controls, Joanne Marr, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco if you live in San Francisco or Marin County. The Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.